Welcome to the V-Wave Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by River Runners for Wilderness and is created by a cast of river lovers who understand the river resource comes first. On the shoulders of a healthy river, do we recreate ourselves? What comes second is river access, a very thorny V-Wave, all in itself. The V-Wave discusses these things and river ecology, recent river trips, river history, river management, and new changes on rivers. Have a topic you'd like to hear more about or help discuss? Get in touch with me, your host, Tom Martin, at rrfw.org. That's T-O-M-M-A-R-T-I-N at rrfw.org. Special thanks to Char and Trev, who came up with this idea. Today, I'm with Ev Baher Murphy.
Yeah.
And my name is Tom Martin. We are at the kitchen table in our house in Flagstaff, Arizona. And Ev, thank you so much for being here today. This is a real treat. You've got a podcast called The Lifeblood, Glen Canyon, Lake Powell, and the Future of the Colorado River. Is that right?
Yeah.
Cool. Very, very good. And you're supposed to be interviewing me, so why don't you go first and then I'll turn the tables around.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me in your home.
Thank you for coming.
Well, I guess a way I like to start some interviews, since this is a double interview, is just with, and I'm sure your listeners know, so this will be redundant, but who are you and what would be like a paragraph or two summary of your relationship to the river or sort of... Yeah, your expertise, which I know is vast and spans many years.
Yeah, it spans many years because I'm an old man. But my mother and father got the family into the Grand Canyon in the 1960s and on the river. And so that got us involved in that. And then, you know, ever since I've been, Hazel and I, my wife, we live here in Flagstaff to be close to the river, because certainly Grand Canyon, but it's been amazing to explore up and down the river and look at the history. What was the river like before the dams? What were river runners saying before the dams? What was the ecology doing before the dams for the last, oh, few hundred thousand years, or how many millions of years, 10 million years? What's going on here? And then we show up in this little snap. And what do we know? Or what do we think we know? And what are we doing to the river to serve our needs that's going to really hammer everything else? So that's all I got.
Awesome. Well, that's exactly what I'm focusing on. The second season of the Lifeblood podcast is like the living river. So I'm curious sort of what you've learned about the pre-dam environment, the pre-dam ecology. What was that like?
If I was going to try to describe the pre-dam river, it's a sine wave, an irregular sine wave that is low in the summer and low in the winter, with occasional weird punctualities. Example would be September 1923, at 100,000 CFS comes rolling out of Little Colorado River. So these floods are, but typically the river is breathing. It breathes out, drops down, breathes in, and floods up. And that's going to follow the snowpack in the Rockies that's going to fall in the winter and melt in the spring and head to the sea. And these, you know, the Colorado Plateau is a whole bunch of sea sediments, and it's all being eroded out and taken away, going down to the Sea of Cortez. So you start in the mountains, you have these clear streams that eventually start picking up and eroding out sediments, banks cave in, trees fall in, that sort of stuff. And so you end up with the Rio Colorado, a Red River, going to the sea. And at the Sea of Cortez, you have this incredible feast of ecology with hundreds of thousands of seabirds and all types of fish species, and this incredible biology happening there, where a big river delta meets the sea, which... before we as a species were on the planet running around, that was a big deal, and it still is a big deal today. So here's this amazing living system that connects the Rocky Mountains to the sea over 1,500 miles. The river would be clear at times. The river would be incredibly cloudy at times, too thick to drink, too thin to plow, right? No. Yeah, something like that. But at times it would really clear up. And the green was called the green because it had this green tinge to it. So it's just, it's this living system where the Colorado pike minnow would hatch up in the high country and go out to the sea, just like the salmon in the Pacific Northwest, and then come back at the, as a 6 foot long, incredible cruiser and start that system all over again. The snails, the mayflies, the whole, this incredible system that would feed itself. And the temperatures were freezing in the winter. You could walk across the river. In the summer, the temperature up in the 70s and higher down basin toward Needles and Yuma, the really, really warm water. And the native fish could handle this huge swings. They didn't have eyes because they didn't need them, because when the river's really muddy, what are you going to see anyway? But they were really aware of their surroundings and you know, just amazing species. So that's a little snapshot of my understanding of the river before we started working on it.
Wow. And so some of those iconic species you mentioned would be the Colorado pike minnow. What others like come to mind when you think about?
Humpback chub, the bluehead sucker, the flannel mouth. There's a whole list. I could look it up. You know, I mm-hmm. rely on the scientists to make those lists. I just remember a couple and that's it, you know? Yeah.
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 But those fish are out there and they were cruisers. So as part of my research of trying to put river running on the river and the history of that, mm-hmm. I do oral histories. And I interviewed a fellow, he's passed away now, his name was Alan Malmquist. And in the 1960s, about 1964, he drove his little low clearance car down this dirt road, started in Peach Springs on the Wallapai Reservation and went down Diamond Creek Road, but eventually his little car wouldn't do it, so he walked down to the Colorado River. It's about 20 miles or so. He walked the last two or three. Got to the river, and he was surprised to see there were some fishermen there with their fishing poles, and they're down at the water's edge, and there's a little Jeep there that they've driven on. And eventually they turn and they see him, and they shout, and they drop their little fishing poles, and they run towards him. And he's like, oh, well, what did I do? And they're so excited. They run up and say, hey, we don't know who you are. We don't know why you're here, but come look at our fish. And he's like, okay. So they walk him down to the creek. There's a small creek that runs year-round in Diamond Creek. And in that creek, tied with gill lines, are 2 6-foot-long pike minnow.
Wow.
And I got to thinking, as Alan and I were talking, that those fish would have been alive when the Hoover Dam came in and separated them from the sea.
Mm-hmm.
So they lived out their life above that reservoir, and they got fished out of the river by these fishermen at Diamond Creek.
Wow.
So that's kind of where I'm going, and as I start opening this up, and what the things that I find in the history before the dam.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting thinking about like we know today that we have a really fragmented river system with fragmented ecosystems, but that these fish are pretty long lived, the native fish in the Colorado River, and that there would be generations that lived through 1, 2, or 3 dams now, truncating their ecosystems and keeping them in new kind of sections of river.
Absolutely.
And today you'd never find a pike minnow.
What's that doing to their genetics?
Mm.
Right? It's like highways, what the highways do with species
on
either side of that 24-hour flow of traffic.
Yeah.
7 days a week, 365 days a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of fragmentation. And I'm sure, this fish geneticist who work on that within stalking and that whole world is something I'm still learning about.
Yeah.
Super interesting to think about that fragmentation. Um, I guess if we follow this thread, and I'm sure you've talked to a lot of people about this, and there's many stories about that transition from you have this pre-dam, huge river system, and what starts happening as the dams come in, what changes are seen, what does that do to the river and the species that are living in it and have evolved alongside of it?
Yeah. So what I've learned is, to build a dam, you need to put it on bedrock, and that needs to be dry or dry-ish. To do that, you need to build a dam upstream of your dam site and downstream of your dam site and pump that water out of there and get in there with your machinery and scrape that down until you can get down to solid rock for a foundation. And this is how Hoover Dam was done. This is how Glen Canyon Dam was built. This is how Flaming Gorge was built, and. So the first thing that happens is when you need to get down to the dam site with some sort of road structure, then you start building the diversion tunnels that are going to take the water from above the dam site, put it in the tunnels, and get it to below the dam site, upstream of the upper diversion dam and downstream of the lower diversion dam. And it is simple, the mechanics of how you're going to do this as an engineer. As soon as you build that upper diversion dam, you start flooding the upstream resources. So right away, you're starting to change a free-flowing system into a pool drop. Now, a pool drop is not unknown to the river. This is how rapids form, and some rapids are pretty super big. And when they happen, they end up making a river-wide dam, which the water goes over. And eventually, after years of breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out, with big breath, the river's going to blow that dam out of there, which we will do to these dams as well. Just wait time enough. So the first thing you have is above the cofferdam upstream, where you're still running the river out, and the fish can still go through the diversion tunnels. And they will do that because they're good swimmers. And they'll be playing in there going, what's this all about? Oh, cool. All right, anyway, that's what happens there. Eventually, the dam gets big enough that the diversion dams can be closed, either with valves or permanently sealed. The reservoir then starts immediately building up upstream of the cofferdam, eventually overtops the cofferdam and washes that material down in the base of the dam. But the designers don't care because that's what they've done. Now you start controlling downstream resources as you flood upstream resources. And this is common knowledge. I mean, I'm not making, that's just, it's simple. This is what happens. So suddenly what you've done is you've, as you said, you've made a genetic wall, and you've isolated species, and you've isolated certainly the fish ability to go upstream, downstream. And the riverers who were opposed to the Upper Basin Storage Act in 1956, 55, help me.
Close.
they were pissed. They were irritated. They were seeing these amazingly beautiful places, and they knew they were going to be destroyed. Whether they were thinking about the downstream resources, the upstream resources, or whether they were wise enough to look at both. And there's all kinds of people out there that some got it upstream, some were worried downstream, and some said, this is going to be a mess upstream, and it's going to be a mess downstream. So they saw that happening. The sedimentation then that starts happening. Now you would have some, again, with a natural system, you're going to have some huge flood that's going to, or a landslide, some sort of mega event that's going to make a dam, a natural dam. That's going to then sediment up, and that's going to help overtopping of the dam and eventually the destruction of the dam. So sedimentation is a part of the process as well. The other thing that has happened that I find absolutely fascinating is the landforms themselves, where you have a reservoir and you inundate landscapes that were dry, you have the ability to cause, I don't want to use the word liquefaction, but you'll end up with landform slumps. And we see these in Upper Glen Canyon, caused by Glen Canyon Dam and the reservoir that its impoundment made. So we were up there a few years ago, Hazel and I, and we camped on a slump island. It was nothing but sand and big blocks in all different types of chaotic positions, really different from the geology that we were in. So the upper basin is being totally transformed by these huge landmass slumps. So that's number one. The other thing that's happening is water has power, and wind-driven water has power. Mm. And when that happens 24/7, 365, that water and that wave action transforms landscapes. Mm-hmm. So we've been doing some oral history rematching, and part of my oral history is I'm going to talk to people if they've run Glen Canyon before the dam. I always want to know where their photograph set is, and is it in an archive somewhere? Mm-hmm. That's super, super important. And try to make sure that happens. And some people are like, nope. They know that family curation is best, and so do I. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, let's get this in an archive somewhere so it can last the test of time. It doesn't go to the dump. Mm-hmm. The great post-death of our elders dump, right? Where we gather up all the shit and throw it away. So in some of our photo rematching, the analogy I'll use is we're sitting here at our table. There's a couple mics here. There's a can of soda and there's a cup of tea and a book. And then far away on the other side of that room there, there's a sink and some dishes and a bunch of books. And so in this historic photograph, I will see the table, the cans, the book. I will see the washer dryer. I'll see the trash can. I'll see the recycling bin. And in the distance, I'll see the books and the sink. When I rematch the photo and I'm at the exact photo station, I see the soda and the cup of tea. I see the book. I see the table. I look in the distance. I see the sink. I see the frame picture. I see all the cookbooks there and the cabinets. That's all there. But the washing machine's gone. The trash can's gone. The recycle bin's gone. And it's mind-blowing to see what the reservoir surface water has done as the reservoir goes up and down to blow out the landscape and make it unidentifiable to what that landscape looked like before that dam. Mm-hmm. And we're not talking about, I mean, one of the places we went to was an archaeological structure, probably 1,000 years old, and it was, I don't know, maybe 30 feet by 30 feet square by 20 feet high. This is a big structure. And Hazel and I, we had this little photograph, and we wanted to rematch that thing. And I was walking around going, where is it? And I walked for a good hour, walking around, looking for this thing. I couldn't find it. Until I realized that where we had pulled the boat in to get out of the boat was exactly where it was. And as the reservoir dropped, the river ended up pointing right at this thing, and it swept the entire thing on downstream. Gone. So these are some of the changes that we're seeing. One more change. Oh, no, that's just enough. Where the sediment is moving into the upper areas of these large dam systems, and this is going to be for Hoover and its reservoir behind it, and Glen Canyon Dam and the reservoir behind it, there are hundreds and hundreds of acres of sediment with nothing growing on them. The tamarisk are all dead, and they will not repopulate because they don't have the water source. So when the reservoir drops low enough, we are making wonderful wasteland. Mm-hmm. And the sediment in the soil is salty enough. You got to be a pretty hardy plant to want to grow in that kind of environment. Mm-hmm. So that's what I've got for what was there before and what is there now.
Yeah.
What do these systems do?
It's like new ecological habitat that only certain plants or fish can survive in, but also like new geological processes are happening just by virtue of that being a windy lake at times.
Yeah.
A reservoir.
Yeah. And so these are things that I've found that I'm just like putting me back, rocking back on my feet and go, wow, look at that. Mm-hmm. And it took me a long time to realize why I wasn't seeing the refrigerator, why I wasn't seeing the washer, dryer, and the trash can in my own kitchen. They were mm-hmm. gone.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, duh.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Wow. Fascinating. I mean, I can continue on this thread.
Wherever you want to go.
Yeah. I'm curious in your oral histories, if you've encountered, like, we both have this river system going from being a big, long river to being very fragmented and these huge dams and storage and irrigation projects going in. And sort of in that time, or sort of after that main dam building period, we have the Endangered Species Act and these environmental acts coming into play in the 70s, and I think representing a shift in values of how we're approaching natural resources. And I'm wondering, in your oral histories and talking to people at that time, like what that transition was like, maybe for river runners, or I know then we start having attention on the native fish that have been largely extirpated from a lot of these sections of river. And I'm sort of curious, like that time period of the 70s and like what that shift was like in values and agencies kind of shifting over to saying, oh, we're actually, the Bureau is no longer maybe a dam building agency. We're still building big infrastructure, but now we're also having to look at how this infrastructure is impacting all the life that depends on those areas.
Right. So that reminds me, the other thing I forgot is typically if you're a dam builder, once you have your dam built, you want to poison the downstream river and drop in your best exotic fun to catch fish. And so that happened as well.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's interesting because I've talked with people who, I talked with a gentleman, a really wonderful guy who worked at the White Canyon Uranium Concentrating Mill. You know where that is?
No.
Do you know where Old Height, not New Height, not the New Height Marina, which is closed right now, but the actual Height Ferry is about, I don't know, 7 or 8 miles downstream from today's Height Marina that's okay. abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
Does that put you on the map here? I mean, we're at the end of Cataract Canyon, then you go into Narrow Canyon, at the end of Narrow Canyon, the confluence with the Dirty Devil,
mm-hmm.
about 10 miles downstream. That's
okay.
Old Height.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 50s, it was uranium, right? Uranium was everywhere. So this gentleman, he's in college, so he's in his late teens, early 20s. He's working at the concentrating mill. That concentrating mill and all its concentrate that they didn't take away from the plant is 100 feet under sediment right now,
mm-hmm.
waiting.
Mm.
Waiting for what? His vision of his life was pretty comfortable, and the things that happened in the 70s didn't affect him that much.
Mm-hmm.
The people that were river running in the 70s probably were supportive of the Clean Water Act and the Antiquities Act and all of the amazing legislation that happened in the 70s when we realized, hey, we are really hurting the planet. And we had the ability in our governance to make some pretty amazing legislation mm-hmm. to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that I've interviewed anyone who said everything was great until the 70s,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the generation before that might have said, yeah, that's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
The generation after that thought it was a good idea until we got the day, and I don't know, all bets are off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got to ask you, because you are that generation now, and your vision of politics is probably, I'm going to guess, 10 years back,
mm-hmm.
when you became politically aware and started looking at, hey, what was going on?
Mm-hmm.
My rearview mirror, your rearview mirror, yeah, I got you for 10 years. My rearview mirror at now, I'll give it 55 years. Okay, I'm
mm-hmm.
almost 70. I've seen a lot more stability and then a lot of perturbation at the end. You're living in a perturbation. So we're,
mm-hmm.
so you're asking a kind of interesting question of when government makes a change, what does the consciousness of the country do? Well, the consciousness of the country brought about that change.
Mm-hmm.
So in my research, what I've discovered is, take, for example, the Wilderness Act, passed in 1964, introduced 10 years before
mm.
as a last-ditch Hail Mary to save Glen Canyon
mm.
because Glen Canyon didn't get axed in the Echo Park fight. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so you see this pull back and forth between people that want to, you know, Canyonlands, as Utah senators said, we don't want Canyonlands National Park to be any bigger than it is because we want that rock for concrete. Mm. Right. So here's the progressives, if you will, over here, or the destroyers, however you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And then there's people that are saying, hey, we need a living river. Mm-hmm. This dam is going to destroy that. Mm-hmm. So I think to answer your question, is no, I really haven't found anyone who has bridged that gap that saw it before it was and saw it after it was that really didn't like it. I will add that almost to a man and a woman, in the oral histories I've done, the people that boated Glen Canyon before the construction of Glen Canyon Dam, and this includes elders in the church, and we're talking about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, mm-hmm. People who hate wilderness, they were like, you know, that dam was a bad idea.
Mm. Wow.
Because they saw it before the dam and what the dam did. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot of people, a lot of boaters that, don't get me wrong, they'll say, I love Lake Powell. Boy, it's beautiful. And I'll say, yeah, I've been out on that lake. It is incredibly beautiful. You are exactly right. But it is a reservoir. And what it was before what it is now, it's hard to even describe. Mm-hmm. So, did that answer your question?
Yeah. I think it got to it.
Okay.
For sure. I'm curious about that. I don't know about the Wilderness Act and its origins within that Echo Dam fight. I was wondering if you could expound on that a bit.
Yeah. So this is what I discovered digging through the archives all across the country to put together the first volume on the book of Doc Marston, the river historian. And I needed to look at the river and how we were managing it. So in the National Archives in Washington, D.C. at College Park, there's a whole box on Escalante National Monument that was never built. Mm. And it goes into the Echo Park dam fight. And there's a ton of letters and communication on that. Also, not in that archive as well, but in Otis Marston's archive. Mm-hmm. So I start putting these two archives together and realize that the environmental community, and people typically say, oh, the Sierra Club, David Brower. I'm like, Brower was a component of the National Parks Association, now the National Parks Conservation Association, the Isaac Walton League, the Wilderness Society, church groups and garden clubs and doctors, lawyers, and janitors and river runners of both political persuasions saying, build a dam and saying, don't build a dam. Mm-hmm. But the group that was saying, don't build a dam was a whole bunch of people, and very few of them mm-hmm. were saying, don't build Glen Canyon. Mm-hmm. Glen Canyon had no anchor. Mm-hmm. Echo Park had an anchor of the National Park Service mm-hmm. as a national monument. Glen Canyon, it's out there in the public domain mm-hmm. on its own. So the crafters that were going to win Echo Park, but they realized they had lost Glen Canyon. This is before David Brower ever took a river trip in Glen Canyon. They were like, hey, we are losing this incredible place because we have no anchor. So let's craft legislation in the Wilderness Act that says citizens can put together wilderness legislation. And if they can get a senator or a congressperson to put it on the table, it can become law. Mm. And it doesn't anchor into the Park Service. It doesn't anchor into the Forest Service or BLM. It covers everything. Mm-hmm. Bigger than 5,000 acres, no roads, no power lines. It has to meet these requirements. Mm-hmm. Then there can be law to make an area wilderness.
Wow.
And the hope was to get this bill in through Congress mm-hmm. and then run to Glen Canyon and put that thing in there. Mm-hmm. And it was a last-ditch Hail Mary. And I like to think that there were some senators and congressmen on the in quotes, air quotes, progressive side, mm-hmm. you know, the ones that want to make the concrete out of Canyonlands, you know, mm-hmm. They're like, oh, we're just going to stall this thing until that concrete starts pouring on that dam site. Mm-hmm. But there were actually, it was more nuanced and certainly more complicated than that, because cattle grazing was a big deal. Mm-hmm. And the Park Service was like, no, you know, we don't want any kind of legislation that puts cattle in parks. Mm. It makes perfect sense because the Park Service doesn't do cows. Mm-hmm. But eventually it's compromised, blah, blah, blah. So, but that was 10 years in the making there. Mm-hmm. And by then, 1963, Glen Canyon Dam took control of the river. 1964, yeah. That bill passes.
Wow.
Huh. Isn't that fascinating? So you know, I tie this together, and I could be wrong as a historian, right? I don't have a degree in history. I'm a mm-hmm. physical therapist. You know, I can help you get that little finger to move, you know? Mm-hmm. But I could be wrong. Mm-hmm. I could be very wrong. But this is what I find when I do the historical record. And I you got to understand, I do oral histories. I look at oral histories as the spices that make food tasty. Mm-hmm. But I can't live on spices alone. I need that bland food mm-hmm. to survive. Yeah, if I put spices in it, I'll eat more. It's nice and yummy. Mm-hmm. But the meat and potatoes is of history, or the tofu or whatever for us vegetarians is, look, I need the archives. I need the letters. I need the correspondence. I need the journals. I need the photographs before AI got around. Mm-hmm. And that's how I base this understanding on that I just discussed.
Right. Wow. And I don't know all the history of the Endangered Species Act, but I understand that might also come out of the fish kills that were happening in the Colorado River. It's really interesting to think about that legislation, both those like big acts were maybe birthed from conflict and conservation efforts on the Colorado.
And the other part of the Endangered Species Act is Rachel Carlson's Silent Spring, mm-hmm. is DDT and right. birds. Okay, so there's a lot of components. Whenever I look at this stuff, I've learned mm-hmm. to be careful not to hang one thing on yeah. because there were so many players, right?
Yeah.
David Brower, this area. No, wait a minute. There were mm-hmm. dozens of other players all working together trying to communicate and make that happen. Mm-hmm. Now, for Brower and the Sierra Club, they were one of the prime movers to stop the Marble Canyon Dam in mm-hmm. In Upper Grand Canyon and mm-hmm. Bridge Canyon at the end of Grand Canyon, those two dams. There were other dams that were going to be proposed as well. It's a lot of stair-stepping sort of stuff. So a group of people can do a lot, but a lot of different groups of people can do more. Mm. So I digress.
Well, just on a small note, and if you don't have any anecdotes on this, that's totally fine, but I've been really curious to learn more about those, the rotenoning of the Colorado River, or really the Green River in the San Juan. And if you've talked to anyone involved in that or know some of that history, be super curious to learn more about
it. Yeah, so again, in my archive digging in the Park Service's archives is the rotenoned adventures with Flaming Gorge Dam. Mm-hmm. Because downstream of Flaming Gorge is Dinosaur National Monument. So the Park Service people in dinosaurs started noticing a bunch of dead fish. This is when agencies didn't talk to each other, right? Mm-hmm. And there's an agency upstream with 50-gallon drums of this junk just throwing it in there to kill everything downstream. And who knows how far it goes and who cares? Because mm-hmm. we're going to do this, you know, the spillway ramp, the trophy trout. And there's some big trout in there below that dam, Clearwater. Right, you know, that's what they did. So I haven't written that up yet because that happened in 64, 63-ish. But I have read some material about that. Mm-hmm. But that happened, where didn't it happen? Mm-hmm. I mean, at Glen Canyon Dam. Mm-hmm. How to make that trophy trout fishing down to Lee's Ferry. And who cares what's going on down there below Lee's Ferry? That's not our department. Mm-hmm. Oh, really? What do you care when your job is to build a dam mm-hmm. and to make a different fishery of exotic fish at the foot of your dam? Mm-hmm. Wow. So I don't know I know where the date is. I haven't pulled it together yet. Mm-hmm. But that will be part of it. I know the river runners were seeing it, mm-hmm. and they were, some of them didn't care. Some of them were fisher people and thought, hey, this would be great. And some of them were like, this is disgusting.
Yeah. I'm sure, especially the weeks or months or however long that you had, just like thousands,
it's ongoing.
Tens of thousands of
it's ongoing.
Dead fish washing up.
Yeah. And how do we manage today? I think we've pretty much gotten over that, that concept.
Yeah.
But
definitely.
But I know there's some people would dump that stuff in there just to go ahead and do it.
Yeah. Well, now it's used to, within fragmented, like smaller, I don't know that it's happening on like big rivers, but on tributaries in sections that are fragmented because of dams or different obstacles, it's now a tool to say, let's get all those non-native fish out of the stream and we can use this section as great native fish habitat.
Right.
And so, yeah.
So yeah, there it is. And okay, so you're going to use a needle to dig out a splinter out of your finger, mm-hmm. you know, and then you're going to heal up and you're not going to have a splinter in your finger and you're going to throw both those spiky tools away. Mm-hmm. So that's what you're going to do with the rotenone. You're going to kill everything and then try to reintroduce.
Yeah.
Which, you know, the question is, how well can we play God?
Yeah.
And if we're going to play God, we need a godly amount of funding.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't have that, then we're going to fall short of what we need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And right now we're falling short on funding. And nature bats last.
Mm-hmm.
So here we have a drought.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and how is the system? I mean, I'm diverging back away mm-hmm. from fish because I'm not that good at fish. But I'm just thinking Glen Canyon Dam has shown itself to be very deficient when it comes to two things. Mm-hmm. One is flood, too much water, and one is drought, not enough water.
Mm-hmm.
Hoover Dam, on the other hand, it can handle a lot of flood, and it can handle a lot of drought. They were thinking down there. They were not thinking up basin.
Mm-hmm.
So I digress.
Yeah. Well, in the drought, there's already quite a few problems and ecosystem changes just with like what was regular hydrology in the 1900s. But the drought throws everything like upside down, and what it means for ecosystems is all this like new emerging habitat, and also as you were saying, now some more non-native fish coming through the dam and the warmer water and these different things. So
right.
It's a whole new tangle of...
It is, and we've also come to rely on the progressive structure,
mm-hmm.
right? There it is. Millions and millions of people downstream.
Mm-hmm.
There it is. Millions and millions of people upstream in mm-hmm. an interbasin transfer mm-hmm. that at the waterheads grabs water and dumps it into the Front Range of Colorado
mm-hmm.
so they can have their water.
Mm-hmm.
And reclamation, their number one priority is their infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't care about the compact. They don't care about the law of the river. Their number one thing that they want to do is save their infrastructure, as mm-hmm. poorly built as it is.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it be nice if we had some tunnels that actually went through Glen Canyon Dam at about 200 feet?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Then we would kick the can down the road just a little longer.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually the last kick of the can goes over a cliff.
Right.
And that's where we can be at.
Yeah.
So to the engineer's credit, to the progressive credit, okay, Glen Canyon Dam, we got the spillways over top. What are they going to do? Plywood. That's a good fix. Okay, fine.
Mm-hmm.
The north spillway has never been tested.
Mm.
I look at that structure and still think, we're not going to be able to, it still can't withstand a good push from a rain on snow event
mm-hmm.
if the reservoir's fairly full already to start.
Mm-hmm.
So again, too much water, not enough water. Again, we do have mechanisms to litigate, to try to save ecological communities mm-hmm. through the Endangered Species Act, et cetera. But if there's no water, those fish are going to die. Because if we're going to play God, we need to make water. And we're not able to do that, not in the quantities that we need. So if I look in my crystal ball, what's going to happen in the next 5 years? Well, we might, El Nino, it might, but it might not. And we might see another 20 years of drought. Okay? So, you know, what does that mean?
Yeah, that's the question.
What kind of planning are we doing? I love to think about is that Glen Canyon Dam leaks between 500 and 800 cubic feet a second. And if it can't make electricity, and they're not going to use the bypass tubes because they're going to cavitate, and then that will destroy the dam. So Reclamation's not going to do that. Anything that's going to hurt their infrastructure, not going to do, right? Hey, as a river runner, I'm in. But that's just, I mean, it's just one group of people looking at the river for their use, right? I'm a boater and I want to go boating, right?
Yeah.
But some of those fish are going to survive that flow too. So it's like, okay. The trouble is the exotics, and we're talking about the smallmouth bass. They have the potential to just clean everything out. So eventually, if we see the light of day on the other side of this drought, then we can restock that section. But this is an interesting question. Before that happens, do we want to rotodyne the whole thing and take care of all the exotics that are in there, the carp and the catfish?
Yeah. And turns out, I forget the numbers, but I was talking to a fish biologist about, could you, like, what would it mean to, like, connect these ecosystems where you have millions of non-native fish in Lake Powell?
Yeah.
And I don't remember the exact lake, but he was just referencing like a much significantly smaller, way, way smaller reservoir in Utah. And it was like, they barely have enough Roanoke, or like the amount of Roanoke that we produce in 1 year to do this like really small lake is like almost not feasible.
Right. So, so this is where you need to play, to play God, not just by looking at the tail races of Glen Canyon Dam down to the first appearance of sediment in the next reservoir downstream, but you need to look at the health of the entire system from the Continental Divide to the Sea of Cortez. And if we're not able to play that kind of God, we shouldn't be playing the game.
Right.
But it's too late.
Yeah, we already started playing.
We've already played.
We made some big steps in a certain direction.
We're already sitting at the table in Vegas. And we're deep in debt.
Yeah.
But we're addicted to the game. Right? I live on the indigenous land. I have a wonderful house. Oh, how lucky and white privilege am I? Well, good luck with that. And we look to you, the next generation, and you're looking back at us going, well, thanks. You've really stacked a deck for us. Because we have. And I don't know what the answer is there.
One question that was sort of when I first like started this project, I was really curious about how people like yourself who've been interacting with the river for a long time, thinking about it, talking to people about it, how are you imagining the future or your ideal future of this river system? And I know that can look many ways, but when we talk about like how the states are negotiating now and the drought we find ourselves in, it's becoming increasingly like narrow-sighted of like, how do we get through this year in the next 2 years? No, even though all the negotiators know we need a 20-year plan. We need like a 100-year vision of how this infrastructure will need to adapt over the next 100 years. There's no question about that. And like, how do we look generations ahead?
That's right. That's exactly right. And it's so fascinating to see all the little use groups. The river runners want water for their boats. The fisher people want ramps going to water for their exotic fish they can catch. The irrigators want water so they can keep making alfalfa to send to Saudi Arabia. The cities in Tucson and Phoenix and Vegas want water and their swimming pools and the golf courses and the grass. All right. You gotta wait. If the resource comes first, Only on the shoulders of a healthy resource are we going to be able to survive here. That's a rearranging of the entire system. How do we take care of the native fish to keep them from being extirpated by the exotic fish now that we've dumped a bunch of them in the river? Just looking at that alone, as you say, all right, if we start decommissioning dams, let's say we decommission every dam from the Continental Divide to the Sea of Cortez, how long is it going to take us to rebuild that ecosystem? Will the fish that are true to the river, that were there before we as a species showed up, will they be able to handle being preyed upon by fish that really aren't supposed to be there or weren't there? And then that brings up a whole question of who's the latest Johnny come lately? I don't want anybody to come to my neighborhood. I don't want anybody to come to my town. Oh, there's too many people here now, right? And we hear this all across the West, all around the world. There's just too many people. And we don't want any more. Okay. How do we step back? How do we regroup? And that says, all right, we have to remove the big dams. We need a run of the river system. We need to be able to get nutrient loading to the sea, with or without the water that will come and go based on the climate that we are turning the dial up and cooking. If I was an optimist, I'd say, yeah, we're going to get a handle on this. But if I was a pessimist, I'd say, I don't see it working. And nature bats last, with or without us, to pitch the ball. So eventually, in the scope of geologic time, this is just a blip on the radar screen. And all the, thinking about the compact and all the other, what about hydroelectric generation and what about all the methane that's released in the sediments in the tops of these reservoirs? You know, you start stacking all these issues up in a giant pile. With enough time, the planet carries on until the planet doesn't carry on anymore, until the sun gets big enough to like gobble it up. So does that mean we should just walk away and say it'll be all right? No. We need to do what we can now to preserve as much diversity as we can, so that when we're not here, because diversity, if you're looking at ecological systems, diversity is the name of the game. With or without us as a species, there's a lot of species that aren't around anymore. And look at the diversity that we have. Oh, that's pretty cool. So I think things are going to be all right in the long run, but in the short term, there is going to be a lot of pain. And I'm not the first person to say that.
Yeah.
We'll do the best we can.
Yeah. I see, like, or I'm hearing in your response to, like, a call for the future that puts the resource first is a future where there's been a further shift in values and reorienting of how we think about river systems and the way we use water. And I mean, also in that call is a way to wrangle all of our use back in to be within our means, which we know we've been living outside of for some time.
Not just river systems, but the air that we breathe, the oceans that we survive on, that we rely on for our survival. Right? I mean, it's one earth.
Yeah.
And so if we have healthy rivers and we have polluted air, that's not going to work. You know, so we're going to need the whole systems. We're going to have to look at the whole system and what we're doing to it. And we have the ability to do that in our kitchen table at our little house here in Flagstaff, Arizona. We as a species have the ability to do an awful lot of good. If we just think that way.
Yeah.
So we have the ability to do an awful lot of bad, and we've done that too. But I'd like to think that we have the potential to learn from our mistakes. And what we see now isn't working.
Yeah. And it's good that we know that.
Yeah.
We can see that.
Yeah.
We have a lot of good evidence
Yeah.
of things that haven't worked out so well.
we're pretty good at looking at what we've done and looking at what's coming up and saying, yeah, this isn't working. Mm-hmm. And we're pretty good at changing things too. Mm-hmm. So it's an exciting time. It's very interesting. Will we survive as a species? Not sure. In the end, no. And other species will fall by the wayside as well, as they are now in high numbers. But eventually that will plateau out and then spark back up again. Mm-hmm. It may take a lot of time. Mm-hmm. Anyway, now I'm cycling around. I just said this already. So.
Well, I have a couple of questions that I've asked everyone I've talked to, and then I can hand over this baton. and we've kind of touched on this, but why is the Colorado River important to you?
Just because I happen to grow up here, and it was a part of my life, and has always been a part of my life. But if I had grown up as a farmer on the banks of the Ganges, then that river would probably be important to me for the survival of my family and my crops and, you know, my place in society. Mm-hmm. Circumstances were, I was lucky, you know, and here we are. So it's not like I'm from Detroit and I'm like, I want to be about the Colorado River. Mm-hmm. No, it was just here. It was always part of my consciousness mm-hmm. As a person.
It's a place.
Yeah, it's a place. Mm-hmm. Refuge. It's a refuge.
Mm. This next question's along a different line, and you might have multiple responses, but it's what book have you recommended to the most people? And it could be river-related, but doesn't need to be.
What book have I recommended to the most people? Godfrey Sykes' A Westerly Trend comes to mind. And you know that story?
I do not.
So Sykes was a Brit. He came to the U.S. after he had taken some college in engineering, and he got in on some of the last Dodge City cattle drives where the bad guys were shooting it up on the street, and you just sat down on the boardwalk and the bullets would fly over your head and you'd watch who fell on the ground. And he fell in love with the automobile when the automobile showed up. He pushed cattle. He was a cowboy here in Flagstaff at Turkey Tanks, so that's just east of town. And the winter in Flagstaff, not a lot of fun. So he would take the wife and the kiddies to Yuma. He would build a boat. He would boat down to the Delta. He became the foremost authority on the Colorado River Delta. Mm. He would sail with the wife and the kiddies back to Yuma in the spring, sell the boat, come back to Flagstaff, punch cattle. Eventually, he got a job working for the Carnegie Institution in Tucson, Arizona, at the base of Tumamoc Hill, if you know where that is. And at one point, the Carnegie says, hey, we need to go to Japan. There's some things going on over there we need to take care of. So he told his, 10-year-old and 12-year-old kids, look, I'm going to be gone for a couple months. You know where the nuns are at the hospital. A quarter mile away. They'll feed you once a day. Make sure the chickens are fed. Make sure the horses are taken care of. I'll be back. And the kids did just fine. This was a different time. So as the foremost authority of the Colorado River Delta, Sykes, he loved progress. He loved the automobile. He missed the horse, but he loved, embraced the automobile. He writes his memoirs just after the first nuclear bomb is dropped by America in the atomic age. And he writes about things that were totally transformational within technology. And one of the things he mentioned was the radio. Mm-hmm. He said, before the advent of the radio, we would gather together, we would get our own musical instruments out, and if we were bad players or bad singers with good players and good singers, we made music together. Mm-hmm. And in the radio, we all backed away and we all turned on our own set and we listened to the radio. We let somebody else do it for us. This is a book that I recommend a lot for a lot of different reasons. To understand what the river was like before the dam, to understand what the dam did to the river. Sykes was all over that. And he saw this technological change. And someone just mentioned the other day, in my oral histories, they were maintenance worker at Hall's Crossing. After Glen Canyon Dam started making an impoundment, Park Service built a marina at Hall's Crossing. Everyone would get together and visit until the computer showed up. And then everybody at night was on their own computers in their own houses. So that adds to what Godfrey's saying. Mm-hmm. So that's a book I recommend. A Westerly Trend.
A Westerly Trend. Awesome.
There's a copy in the library here.
I'll have to check it out.
Go check it out. It's an easy read. It's a lovely read. Yeah.
Yeah. That's all I think I have in my...
Okie doke. Well, I'm going to turn the tables on you here, looking at our time, making sure our gizmos are still working. Yeah, the numbers are still flashing there. In talking with the people that you have now for a year, what have you come away with right now in your understanding of the river and its future survival?
I think in asking that question of what does the, like, your ideal future of the Colorado River look like, or at Lake Powell and Glen Canyon specifically for some of the folks, there was a lot of hope for consensus and collaboration and that people can work together. And that was definitely a thing shared. That's still been very challenging as we see, like, the operating negotiations going on. But there was, yeah, I feel like a very human want for that, like, harmony to be there, even if people are representing, like, very different sort of political or use-based values. And knowing that those things, like, probably will butt heads for a long time. The other thing I saw in talking to people who work in conservation on the river or are working in fighting these really long fights was sort of this, like, idea, and John Weisheit said this, of, like, doing the work and not because you know that you'll see the fruits of that in your lifetime, but because it's the right work to do. And seeing that passion people have, like, for this river and working on its behalf for their future vision, that, you know, might be backed by a bunch of people they know who also had this imagination of what this river can be and how it can live, was really inspiring to see. Yeah.
Cool.
And here, I guess.
Lovely. Awesome. So what are the questions? What one question should I ask you that I haven't?
That's a question to me.
Yeah,
to me. I don't know what the question would be, but I think one thing I found surprising is people's, like, willingness to listen and have conversation across those lines, like, across people who maybe want to see Lake Powell drained, and folks who are really excited about the lake and that they're curious too, about the environment and, like, maybe wanting to learn more. It's less maybe in that cultural circle of that kind of recreation to be telling stories of Glen Canyon, for example. But it's not by any means outside of their radar that we're in this mega drought.
Oh, yeah.
And that this lake is changing and is at a fragile state, and they have a love and appreciation for the way the lake fluctuates. Maybe a little less so now that it's so low and it's reducing access to getting boats on the water, but that there's that recognition. And I think there's a lot of conversations to be had there across these groups that I think in a lot of situations don't interact or are sort of written off of, like, I'm a river runner and I don't want anything to do with,
I don't want to talk to the lake people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And are there a lot of values that are really different? 100%. But, yeah, I think those conversations were, yeah, really, like, sort of,
yeah,
motivating to me to seek to understand more, like, where does their love of this place come from, and how do they conceptualize this place in a way that's really different from someone who's seeing the lake now and also thinking of all of the place it was before and having this other, like, view of it.
Absolutely. You remind me of one last thing. I've been looking at what's called the Canyon Country River Marathon.
Hmm.
You familiar with that?
I'm not sure.
So this was a boat get-together followed by a boat race.
Okay.
And it went from Green River, Utah, mm-hmm. down the Green River to the Confluence, and up to Moab.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
in the spring, there would be 1,000 boats that would launch at Green River. They would go down to Anderson Bottom. They would have a big old cookout. They would all get totally drunk. They would have a big dance in the morning. They would wake up eventually because the sun would beat them up and get them going again. And they would go down to the Confluence and motor up to Moab.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was followed by the race, where hundreds of participants trying to go as fast as they could would start at Green River, Utah, down to the Confluence and up to Moab.
Mm-hmm.
Canyon Country River Marathon. After the construction of Glen Canyon Dam, that event died.
Hmm.
And I asked the dismoralized some people, and what did they think killed it? And they said, the reservoir behind Glen Canyon Dam, because the water was clear, you could drive fast, and the fishing was good.
Hmm.
So it's just interesting to see how things change in the different use groups.
Mm-hmm.
You adapt, you roll with the punches.
Yeah.
And so we're all going to be doing that now. That's great.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. The reason you value certain places changes, or, I mean, there is a huge, that's something I'd like to learn more about, is where do these values for game fish come from? And like, there's like a huge history behind game fishing and,
oh yeah,
in those species in particular, being like yeah. super fun.
Yeah.
And great for the sport.
Right.
Yeah. within that context and like, yeah, how does that, those values get imported westward?
And how do they,
mapped
how,
onto
do they how do they take priority over a fish that's been there for millions of years
mm-hmm.
that doesn't fight?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
Just a humpback chub that loves to eat spaghetti.
Loves to eat spaghetti and is a, that's a happy fish and doesn't want to fight.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Yeah. It's a, yeah, it's a really like fascinating puzzle to me. And I think, as you said, like, having that 10-year span to look back and being born into this mega drought, like that's all I know.
Yeah.
It's a
yeah.
very different,
yes.
Yeah. Sort of
and
like.
Then those of us went through 83 that yeah. went through reservoirs being full, that you would have to row across lots of flat water. Yeah. 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 Totally, totally interesting to see it. I just find it fascinating to see it so dry, so wet. This is the system. This is the system.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can understand that we need to survive within the confines of these huge environmental magnitudes, if we need everything right here, we're in trouble because it's going from way down there to way up there.
Yeah.
And we need to be able to roll with those punches.
Yeah.
Cool. Are we good?
I think so.
Okay. Well, I just want to thank you, Ev Baher Murphy. I really appreciate you taking the time. It's fun to have two podcasters sit down and talk about the same thing. It's lovely.
Yeah.
So thank you.
And thank you so much.